Hi, this is Craig Ballantyne, host of Early to Rise Radio. Have you ever wanted to become wealthier, healthier, wiser, or just have more time to appreciate the finer things in life? On this show, we reveal what high performers are doing every day to be more successful without sacrificing their personal lives. Early to Rise Radio is sponsored by the Perfect Day Formula. Get your free copy of this game-changing success guide at freeperfectdaybook.com. Now let's get started with today's show. Rob Hanley, welcome to the show. Are you ready to get people recession ready and inflation prepared?
I am ready to get people recession ready and inflation prepared. That is awesome. Actually quite a tongue twister.
Second time you've been on the show this year. And you know, earlier we were talking about a lot of the changes that you had made kind of from some of the stuff that I had shared with you. Now I want to go and ask you a lot of high-level questions because there's so many entrepreneurs listening who know that inflation is already happening and who feel that a recession is coming. And so how do they best prepare for that? So there's nobody better that I could ask than you. So take that as a compliment, and you ready to rock?
Yeah, I'm ready. I hope I can do everyone justice as we dig into this and they find a couple of nuggets they can use and apply immediately.
Yeah. So right now you're coming to us from Lisbon, Portugal. Well, weeks ago, you were in Mexico with me at my mastermind. Yeah. And although you didn't necessarily focus on inflation and recession there, you did teach financials, like understanding financials and helping the business owners in the room. What was the main message you wanted to get across? And then what, based on the questions back, did you see as like where people really needed help?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of the stuff that I want to get across with people was the stuff that's in that course that I put together, the Financial Engineering for Fun and Profit, which is, it's about understanding how the money flows through your business. And once you have a clarity or a perspective on that, you know how to measure it, then you can control it. And then you can actually keep more of the money you make. And one of the things with entrepreneurs, I think, is that there's so much focus on vision and creating and building, but not a lot of focus on how much cash is this putting in my pocket. And that was really the big thing that we wanted to communicate. And to help people do that, we gave them a handful of ways that they could go and find more profits in their business, whether it was through things like variable compensation, so tying employee payment to performance, or other things like just go and look at all the expenses you have and figure out what category they fit in and make sure you spend on the right ones and don't spend on the others. That's the big takeaways for us.
Yeah. And did you see that people were particularly struggling with something, like, or that most business owners that you speak with, it's like, you know, you really need to get this fundamental down because that's a big problem that, you know, because again, we love to go and launch new projects and stuff like that.
Yeah. So there's two things that really struck me. The first is that a lot of the people who did approach me really cared. It was like something clicked inside. They were like, right, you know, I've got to sit down. I've got to ask you a question. I'm curious about this. And they started to speak in what I would refer to as a different language, because the language of sales is very different to the language of finance. And, you know, I've learned this, and you know, I've done a bunch of turnarounds now, which have, you know, helping companies find where that capital is. And you do really realize that it is a separate language. So that was the first thing, was that people, some of them got it. But I think for the other people, there are a few people that just, it didn't click immediately. And part of the reason for that is for the last 10 years, you haven't had to worry too much about finance. Everything's been easy to sell. Everyone's had money. Everyone's been willing to pay for things. There's been a lot of increase in things like Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, TikTok, where you're encouraged to consume. And because there's an environment of consumption and the prices, you know, the inflation just hasn't been crazy, the price has been pretty steady, you just haven't really had to care about it. As long as you keep selling, there's money in the bank.
Well, so, well, provided you were not in the restaurant industry in
2020. That's true. 2020 and 2021 absolutely were difficult. But I would still say the vast majority of entrepreneurs, at least in that room, the vast majority had online businesses or were able to transition online. Yeah. And I think that's the thing. As long as people are willing to buy and at a greater volume, as long as you don't spend everything that comes in, it feels great. Yeah. But what happens if sales drop 30%? How do you survive? Can you survive? How's your business structured? I think these are things that people haven't had to think about for the last decade. So it's a very new area and it can be quite intimidating.
Exactly. That was the word I was going to use. You know, finance can be intimidating with some of the terms. And so when we mentioned some terms on this call, I definitely want to define them. So first of all, like, what the heck? I think people can understand inflation, which is price increase, but you're welcome to define that. But then what is a recession? It was just like when businesses don't make much money, but what is it particularly? And then we can, now that we have the definitions, we can start to figure out how to play the game better.
Yeah, sure. So one of the things I like to do is keep things as simple and pragmatic as possible. And what I want to make sure our call focuses on is not, oh my God, the markets are falling, but like the real economy, like what's actually going to affect you and I in our day-to-day lives. So a recession inherently is a drop in GDP, a drop in economy. People are spending less. That's it in a nutshell, as far as it affects us. People are going to be more concerned about where they spend because they'll have less discretionary income. So if you think of the average person, let's say, just for simple math, they have $5,000 that comes in each month before tax. Some goes to tax, some goes to rent, which is stable. But then those other discretionary items become more expensive. Maybe it's the cost of bread, cost of flour. Maybe it's the cost of honey. Maybe it's the cost of going to the movies. Everything goes up a little bit. Netflix unveils a new plan that says HD, you auto-subscribe to a new $20 plan instead of $14. And as everything goes up little by little, they have less money to spend because their income isn't going up at the same rate as their expenses, or in proportion, I should say.
Yeah, and so inflation has a huge role in this. And so you've recently been traveling around the world. So you came from Portugal to Mexico, brief stop in Bogota, Colombia, on the way down to Uruguay, then to Buenos Aires and Argentina, and then back to Portugal. So you've seen a little bit of at least the Central and South America, and see, and you talk to so many, you know, you and I have a lot of mutual friends all over the world. So what are you seeing in the price increases around the world? Are they consistent throughout? And are they, you know, is America getting hit harder? Because most of the people listening to this are Americans, so is inflation more important to them? But what are you seeing right now? And what are you seeing, you know, in your home country and in the EU in terms of inflation?
Sure. Broad question, but basically number go up, things are getting more expensive. And the way that I look at this is I ask my assistant what she's noticing because she shops in different places to me. So I ask her what she's seeing in the grocery store versus what I'm seeing where I order things from. In Portugal, there is definitely increases in prices. I saw a thread a little while ago on Reddit of a guy who had manually tracked the price of milk, bread, eggs, and things like this every time he went to the store for a couple of months. And it was like 20%, 30%, 50% on some things. Other things, 2 to 3%, but the price is going up. In Cancun, when I came to visit you in Mexico. So I've been back through Mexico a couple of times in the last few, 18 months or so. And immediately I don't notice it because the hard part is the transition from euros and dollars to pesos. That's the tough one. But one of the things I did notice was we went to a cafe one day on the Sunday to go get breakfast, my partner and I. And as she and I were there, we're like, wow, this is like surprisingly expensive. Like, the cost of this breakfast, given that we're in Mexico and the reputation Mexico has and the average income in Mexico, this is a surprisingly expensive breakfast. It's not in proportion. I think this is the other part of inflation that people don't necessarily think about, which is a local element of supply and demand. So places like Cancun, Tulum, areas of Playa del Carmen are more expensive than your average. And they continue to go up because people flock there thinking it's cheaper. They drive the prices up. All of a sudden becomes expensive, it becomes untenable, and that drives the need for either more people to come and replenish it, or you need to get the locals to be able to purchase in or to buy in. So that's something I've definitely been seeing as a longer trend. And then finally, in terms of comparing like Buenos Aires in Argentina to Lisbon in Portugal, Cancun in Mexico, and then Montevideo and Punta del Este kind of areas in Uruguay. It's my first trip to Uruguay, so I haven't got a baseline, but we went out one night with some friends of friends. And they were just telling us, like, Uruguay's expensive, man. Like, it's an expensive place. Everything's expensive. And that really, really caught my ear because it's not something you often hear about Uruguay. But when you talk to people who live there, they do say the cost of living is going up. It's all, it's being acknowledged and recognized. On the flip side, when you go down to Buenos Aires, we spoke with a few locals, but they've had all sorts of issues. Like, their biggest problem is actually just the depreciation of their Argentinian peso. That has fallen so much year after year. If you pull up a graph right now and just look at the value of the Argentinian peso to the US dollar, you'll be shocked at how much it's fallen. It will actually make your eyes water. And a mutual friend of ours who had lived there for a while said to me before I went, he was like, yeah, back when I lived there, people would spend half their time, it seemed, figuring out how to beat inflation. Because you get your paycheck today, you want to go spend it immediately. Because if you hold onto it for 2 weeks, you can't buy as much. The value of what you have, it's shrunk. So what we're basically seeing then, to wrap this all up and make it less adventure capitalist and more just pragmatic and real, is look, inflation's here. It's kicking on. Like, it's not going to disappear. The way that's going to directly impact you is that, first of all, people are going to be more cognizant of how they're spending their money and probably more risk averse. It's not as easy to spend when you've got news blaring at you that everyone's going to lose their job and the economy's going in recession, it's going to crater and everything's horrible. That makes people uncomfortable. So it means that you have to adjust what you're giving people based on what they're asking for and willing to pay for. So guarantees will become more popular, buy it for life type guarantees or quality of product. You have to actually realize that you may think you've been competing for dollars over the last decade, but you haven't been. Nothing like what you're comparing it to now, because it used to be a decision of, do I buy three t-shirts or two t-shirts from this brand or two on that one? Now I'm hearing from one of my clients that people are coming into retail stores, and where they used to buy two t-shirts, they're only buying one. They're actually reducing their spending because they just don't have as much discretionary income. So something to be aware of, and it's affecting everyone.
Yeah. And so, you know, the other day we talked in preparation for this podcast about 2022 to 2024 and, you know, what, you know, everybody has to look into a crystal ball, but what does Rob see in his crystal ball, and how will that mean that it isn't going to be business as usual going forward?
Yeah. So my favorite perspective on this actually came from a client of mine, and we were talking about what happened in the financial crisis, 2008, you know, subprime mortgage collapse. And his point was that for about 4 to 6 weeks, people were like, oh no, what do we do? How's this going to work? Is the money ever going to come again? Right? That instinctive fear. And then you just figure it out. So I want to start this whole conversation with a very clear thing of, at least as far as I see it, humans will endure. We're going to figure it out and things will change. Business as usual doesn't matter. But the reason that it's going to change so much for us is because of how we look at the world. So a really simple example of this, or a comparison, is that as you look at your P&L, you may have made, let's just use a simple number of $100,000, right? It might have been in a month, might have been in a week, might have been in a year. And your profit on that $100,000 might have been 20%. And so 12 months later, you make another $100,000 and you say, well, you know, I only made $15,000 this year in profit. What happened? Or in the same time period? And it's because we're looking at it in raw dollars. That's the number one issue, is we're looking at it in raw dollars. So when we think of everything in raw dollars, these price increases scare us. Things being expensive sounds bad. But the real thing that always matters is this idea of common sizing. So for those who don't know, common sizing is you take all your expenses and you look at them as a percentage of your revenue. So if I spend $10,000 on $100,000 of revenue, well, that's 10%. If I spend $12,000, it's 12%. And this is really, really valuable to understand, because as far as I'm concerned, inflation is only a problem if I can't keep everything moving in proportion. If I can hit my bases, my key numbers, and then keep everything else working within that percentage range, fantastic. So that's the first part. But on the point of percentages, just to keep a wrap around, and I think this is really valuable, is I think it was in the book Economics in a Single Lesson. He talks about, are things actually becoming more expensive, or were they just underpriced before?
Was that a Thomas Sowell book?
No, Henry Hazlitt. Henry Hazlitt. Yeah, so that little line has always stuck with me, because, you know, I live in Lisbon. Now, the minimum wage in Lisbon is 765 euros at the moment, give or take, compared to Buenos Aires, which is 300 and something. And in the center of Lisbon, rents are expensive compared to the minimum wage. Absolutely. As they are in Buenos Aires. And the first question you ask yourself is, are they cheap here? Or was it cheap and now it's the right price? Or was it the right price before and now it's become expensive? Now it's become overvalued. And I think you have to gut check that on everything you're spending on, because maybe you just had a really great company. I was talking to a guy the other day. He's stressed. Get this. He's stressed because his margin is so good, it would make you cry. It's like he doesn't have any expenses and it's a very successful business. And he was stressing that his margin had dropped 5%. But for him, that 5% drop is irrelevant. It's basically irrelevant. Like, the impact that has on his cost structure is irrelevant. Whereas if you are running on 5% and your margin drops 5%, you're stuffed. And I was saying to the guy, maybe you don't realize this, but you've just had this incredible opportunity, this incredible fragmentation in the market you've been able to exploit and get out of this world profits. for a couple of years. And maybe that's coming to a close. Maybe your profit will go down 5, 10%. You still have an incredibly healthy business, one of the best. Just keeping that perspective is to stop you from going irrational with fear and greed. So that's why I want to bring up that point on, is it expensive or is it just the right price now?
So let's say that things are increasing, you know, the common size of, you know, certain, you know, raw goods, cost of goods, that sort of thing, you know, that's massive, massive change. And so now we need to think of, well, what are the steps that we can take inside of our businesses to minimize in the risk or the effects of inflation? So if we think about, you know, addressing mostly here, we're probably thinking about the people who are involved in a physical products type of business. You know, my friend Boris with the supplements and some of the other folks that you and I know, and you've helped Boris out as well. And so, you know, if you were to go back and, you know, we did that one day coaching with Boris, wasn't December, was it?
January.
Okay. So now inflation is probably a bigger threat to him. You know, what would you say to people like that?
Yeah. So the first thing I would say to people is, you need to be clear on how your business makes money. And I mean, in terms of understand what brings cash in and what puts cash out. And then finally, of what put cash out, what if that cash you put out brings more cash in? And most people take this for granted. You know, I've got a bunch of expenses, you know, I pay for a few things. Oh, there might be an expense here or there that I incur unnecessarily. But I mean, really being aware of what are you spending on? So a simple example of this is when I decided to put that financial engineering fund and profit course together, I decided that I would not invest any capital in creating it until I knew people wanted it. I had no interest in that because that's capital I can put elsewhere. And this might sound silly to some people, but you know, the cost of Camtasia, you know, it's 100 or 200 euros. And to be honest, it was months ago now, so I don't call. But I refused to buy that until I knew that it would make money. I'm not going to spend money on something frivolous just because it'd be nice to have if it's not going to return any cash. And I think that's the first thing I'd say to you is pull out your P&L and write down which of my expenses actually is bringing in customers, is monetizing customers, is the infrastructure I require, or is just things I'm spending money on for no reason.
Yeah, that beat down of the P&L is something that I wanted really to push on people in Mexico at the mastermind. Yeah. And you know, whether you're in good times or bad times, it's always a wise idea because... Yep. You know, you can tell the story of what you tend to find in people who have the P&Ls or what they find in their expenses when they do that.
Yeah. I mean, basically what ends up happening is middle of the year at some stage, somebody had an idea in the company. They're like, hey, we should start running webinars. And you start running webinars. This is just a small example and I'll give a big one. So the small example, you start running webinars and Zoom costs you an extra $70 a month or something for that. And so you run a series of webinars that don't work out. And then you forget to cancel it. Now, maybe that's only $400, $500 at the end of the year, but that adds up. On the bigger end of the scale, I met a guy who, a marketing guy, is pretty well known, very, very popular funnel-driven bloke, and most people would know his name. And he and I were talking about his P&L, and I said to him, you know, what are your expenses? Cool, how much are you spending on funnel software you don't use? And we figured out that the amount he was spending was in the tens of thousands on funnel software he no longer used. He could basically hire 1 to 2 full-time employees for the same cost. And the difference is the capital was either being wasted on stuff he wasn't using, or he could have gone and taken that capital and gone and gotten a return, or he could have taken it out of the business and put it into another asset, whatever it was. And you find this all the time. It's not uncommon for me, the bigger a company is, to find, first of all, obvious expenses, like, hey, I'm spending tens of thousands on funnel software I don't use. But the second one is challenging. So challenging people on what are you actually paying for? Like, yes, the money is going out and this is what you're paying for on a label basis, but what's the outcome you're paying for? Because if you're hiring someone and you're spending, say, $180,000 a year on them, what are you actually paying them to bring back? What is the return on that invested capital? What are you expecting to get from it? And is that the best way? If you're spending 180 grand on an analyst, but you could do it with 12 grand in Wicked Report software, just do the 12 grand in Wicked Report software or whatever you choose to use. So those are the kinds of things I always find is the first ones are the obvious and the second ones are the purchasing the expensive version, unnecessarily so.
Another thing that you talked about in that financial engineering course, which is relevant at any time, but especially in these high inflation and recession risks is, you know, making sure you get your billing right, both the billing of and getting the money from customers. So how can you increase that cash collection? And then the billing in terms of you being billed and when you pay. So what is the general advice that you would share with the companies listening today?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing I would really hammer home to people is you need to be measuring how long it takes from when you issue an invoice or give someone credit to when you receive the cash, right? You'll hear me bang this home constantly. It's, you know, you got to measure and you got to measure consistently. And when you understand what that number is, you can start to try and drive it down. Can you incentivize someone to pay faster with a discount or a bonus or something else? On the same tone, how long does it take you from when you receive an invoice to pay the bill? So I was speaking with a banker the other day, a commercial banker, and we were just saying about how one of the biggest problems that business owners have is they want to be nice. They value being paid ahead of time or early, so they will go out of their way to pay other business ahead of time or early. And it's not so much that you should stretch this to the extreme and be a jerk, but when you are giving someone money, the faster you give it, the less you can use it. You can't actually go and get a return on it. You can't deploy it anywhere. And if they say, hey, take 30 days to pay me, and you pay him on day three, well, you're a nice guy, but you just robbed yourself of 27 days worth of cash flow. You could have used that cash elsewhere.
You know, I was just thinking of like an analogy. And if you think of like a sports game, well, you know, there's a halftime, there's a, you know, the breaks and everything. The players could go, well, let's just be really nice and skip halftime so that, you know, people can get home earlier. You know, we'll just do that. You know, we don't want to, you know, have them out too late and they got to go to work tomorrow. So we'll just skip halftime. But, you know, that's obvious that that decreases the performance. You don't get the rest and you don't get the chance to, you know, re-engage with your teammates and think about strategy. So, you know, that's just like a very blunt analogy for it, but
it works. Like my favorite thing that I hear from people, I mean, I stumbled into the interest in finance, to be honest. You know, I was a face-to-face sales guy when I started out. I got into direct response and sales marketing and then deals and all this stuff. But the finance side of things, I stumbled on. And once I started to get familiar with it, I'd want to talk about it with people and really understand, you know, apply it. And a couple of people who I shared how to adjust your cash flow with, they all seem to say the same thing, which is, I feel like I must be doing something wrong to have all this money in the bank. And the thing is, they just finally started doing it right. So for years, people are stressing and managing their bills and their invoices, and there's never really that much money in the, you know, company bank accounts. And then they start managing their cash flow so well that they feel like they're doing something wrong. They feel like they're doing something illegal. And it's really counterintuitive, but you're meant to have a bundle of cash. You're meant to. That's the whole point. If you're not making a surplus, what are you doing?
That actually brings up an important point that I didn't even think to ask about in my list of questions, which is when you are in an inflationary environment or when you're going into a recession, how much cash should your business actually have in the bank?
All right. So let's just for a moment be very clear that this is not a hyperinflation environment we're talking about. You know, no one's going to have to take a wheelbarrow to buy a loaf of bread. There is, in my head, the following things to be aware of. In an inflationary period, you need to have time. Right? You want to have 2 months, 3 months worth of cash in the bank at least. The average business at the start of COVID had less than, I think it was 21 days worth of cash in the bank. There's a report done by this, 21 days or less of cash from small businesses. But really 2-3 months at least. It's the same as your emergency fund. Like I have a 6-month emergency fund. Something could go horribly wrong and my lifestyle will not change for 6 months. It's mine, free and clear, no matter what. And I think it's important to have that same approach to your business, 3 months worth of cash in the bank. Now you can do something like I had a Brazilian client a few years ago who'd keep his emergency fund in treasury bonds or T-bills, sorry. Keep them in T-bills. Short-term deposits, small amount of percent, whatever, but they were safe, right? What you're doing with that buffer is buying yourself time to fix things if your offer stops working, if your market shrinks up, because you have in your business, in your balance sheet, if you will, all this intellectual property and all this business know-how and market know-how. And if you've only got 21 days worth of cash, things aren't looking good if there's a sudden downturn or everyone gets spooked. But if you have 3-6 months worth of cash, protecting yourself, and I'm saying this in particular in small businesses, right? Small businesses are harder to get funding for. They are more risky for banks to loan to, especially in the downturn. If you don't have collateral, you want to make sure you've got your buffer so you buy yourself time for you and your staff to figure out what to do next.
Yeah. So now I want to go, so that was helpful. And now I want to go back to something that you talk about a lot, which is assets to revenue, revenue to profit. And so we use a little bit of a story here. So you and I, 2018 or 19, One of my perfect life retreats, San Diego. Event's over.
18, sorry, yeah.
What's that?
I was trying to place it. It was probably 18, I think.
Okay.
Like in 18.
Yeah, I think it was 18. And so you and I go for a walk after the event. And we were talking about, you know, I'm filling the mastermind. And you said, well, have you emailed this out to your list? Email is, my email list is an asset. I hadn't even thought of, you know, I thought the only way that I could sell people into this mastermind group was in person.
Yeah.
But then walk me through what you said to me and the result.
I mean, to be honest, you tested my memory, but I do recall that walk. And it was basically that case of like, hey, man, like you've got an email list. You've got the people who are already signing up, which means there is demand. And it was just basically leveraging the fact that people are buying now. They're here. You may not be, but you might still want to get in. And I'm pretty sure I just said to you to run like a 3-day campaign or something on it. Something very straightforward. And it was more about you, you had the asset, you know how to do email marketing, but there was a paradigm block, if you will, where you were looking at the in-person stuff to sell the mastermind. I was like, you've got this other asset. Just use that other asset to generate revenue against this.
Exactly. And so we did get, you know, one person, but it was such a high ticket sale that it was, you know, it actually made more money than any other, you know, selling a course during a 3-day email promotion. So it's totally worth it. And so now if you think, okay, the general business owner, whether they have physical products or whether they have online businesses, where are they, where do you see people missing out on turning assets into revenue? And then how do they then go and make sure that they're turning revenue into profit?
All right. Great question. I had this chat with a client today, quite literally assets to revenue. So there's two ways that you can use assets to generate more revenue. The first one is the easy one, which is optimizing what you already have. So if you have a sales funnel, right, that's an asset technically. If you're driving traffic to it through paid or social, doesn't really matter. But are you optimizing that? Are you actually looking at and saying what percentage of people who visit opt-in or what percentage of people buy? If you're not doing that, you are quite literally generating less revenue against fixed expenses or intellectual assets in this regard than you could be. Why would you let it under-optimize or underperform? And a lot of people get really finicky about this and like, oh, well, you know, like it's okay. I'm doing fine. Sure, this is a cultural thing. Seek to make sure that the juice is worth a squeeze, sure. But check if there's something to squeeze, always, you know. We looked at a company 2 weeks ago. And the opt-in page, you enter your details, and then you just get taken to the stock standard CRM thank you page. And like, I was incensed. I was furious. I was enraged because like you're spending all this time, excuse me, you're spending all this capital to hire people and to build content, to generate leads. And then just when someone is at peak level of interest, you send them to a stock standard CRM page that says, thank you, please check your inbox. And I couldn't believe it. It didn't make sense. That is an asset in terms of a conversion mechanism that you are not utilizing. So that's the first thing is general optimization. Actually, I'll give you one more example because I think this is really great, which is thinking about your sales system. So I picked this up, I think it was from Greg Rollette, who may have picked it up from Dan Kennedy, which was a two-step checkout process for info publishing. And it's really simple. What you do is you have your sales page and then someone goes to the buy button. You take them to step one of two, please confirm your name and email. ClickFunnels does this all the time now. And then if they don't complete the purchase, you would have an automation an hour or two later that would say, hey man, just checking in. Everything okay? Did you have a question? What stopped you? And I loved that idea, but I realized that that was still requiring someone to have gotten so convinced or so engaged with what we were offering that I had to wait till they clicked the buy button. What about those people who got to the sales page and got turned off? So we just took the same idea. If someone has visited sales page, clicked, but has not purchased or begun purchase, send email. Hey man, what stopped you? Anything I can do to help? And it's understanding that every asset you've produced, you have to be aware that you probably did a bad job or be open to the idea that you did a bad job and someone can tell you what's missing. You've already put in so much work. Just make it the best version possible. That's the first version. Yes. Yeah.
So the two most important things, probably the things that can give people the two quickest wins cash wise is one, go beat down your P&L.
Yep.
You know, get rid of those subscription services and, you know, my business was guilty of it. We found we saved ourselves $6,000 this year. And we do this all the time because obviously you're a voice inside my head all the time. And we think about it, and we're already pretty good based on the people that are involved in our business, but we still found $6,000. And I think that even through a deeper dive in our tech, we might even find another 5 to 10. We're kind of just debating on whether or not it is, if the juice is worth the squeeze in terms of the amount of tech work that it will take to make the transition. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. So we save the money. Now we go and think, and then the second thing that everybody listening should do is go, wait a minute, I do have assets. And I look at assets as audiences. I have audiences on YouTube, Instagram, email, Facebook. You have these audiences are part assets. And then you have additional assets, like maybe you have programs that you've created that you are no longer selling, or you have inventory that's just sitting there and some people don't even think to just go and liquidate it. So you think of all the assets, how can you turn it into money as quickly as possible? How can you have a garage sale with all the stuff that you have in your business to get the money in as fast as possible? Like if you had to come up with an extra $10,000, $100,000 this month in your business, what would you do? So get the creative thinking there. And so now you've decreased the expenses, you increase your assets, you've got money. Maybe it just gives you some insurance and some lifeline and that sort of stuff. Gives you that 3 to 6 months of cash. And just by listening to this first 30 minutes, you've already had some huge victories in there. So I think that's really important. And then the other thing, Rob, that you said is business owners have to go back and just ask the question, how does this business really make money? And that's kind of the 80-20 thinking. So what 80-20 thinking do you help businesses do, again, whether they're in a recession or whether they're in boom times?
Good question. One of the things that I actually start with is I always look at the fundamentals, right? So I want to understand, first of all, what's going on with the business? I really need to understand this to understand whether it's a strategic issue. So you've got a bunch of assets, but they're no longer performing because the market shifted or the market's no longer interested or there's less purchasing power or there's more competitors. So strategic issues. Then I look at operational issues. Hey, like, are you actually profitable? What is your work cycle like? Do you track performance? So everyone who's ever been in a sales organization has seen the pacing tracker. Okay, how many leads did you contact? How many calls? How many conversions? Who did you follow up with? So we do that for sales, but are we doing that with labor and production? Are we doing that with the inputs in terms of whether it's email sent or outreaches or whatever? Are you tracking those things to see if the business is working? And the last thing I look at is financing. So the financing side is, this takes people a little while to get their head around, but in accrual accounting, which is a theory, profit doesn't exist. It's just an idea. Most people do cash accounting. You typically do cash accounting under 2 million. So if you are doing cash accounting, you're under 2 million, totally fine. It'll work for you. But it is useful to have accrual because it allows you to understand the difference between when you are registering expenses and revenue against each other, like how efficient are you? And then what's your cash movement beneath this? So I'm looking at your face. Is that a little too conceptual? I make it simpler.
This stuff is always puts that kind of look on my face, but it's that intimidation thing, but I want you to carry on with it.
Yeah, cool. Look, finance is really cool. And I'm going to make a book recommendation, which I think everyone should read, which is called The Wisdom of Finance by a guy called Mihir Desai, because he just explains it in a human way, an arts way, where he explains, hey, here's what leverage is, here's what an option is. And he does it without you having to think about numbers and stats and dollars and all this stuff. It's just really easy to read. So if you do have one of those people where you're like, oh, finance is overwhelming, go read this book. It'll make it approachable and easy to deal with. And there's just not as many numbers as you think. So that's the first thing. Second thing is then understanding that your business has a theory on how it makes money. And ultimately that comes down to find a group of people who have a problem. I offer to solve it and they pay me for it. That's it in a nutshell. Or, I find a group of people who want something. I go get it and I go give it to them. And I charge them for it. But the questions beneath that are, when do I pay the people who give me the stuff to give to the customer? And when does the customer pay me? And what are all the other little expenses that help me go get that thing and give it to them? And when you think about it through this real simple lens, it starts to make sense. The catch is that we live in a really conceptual, theoretical world now. Most things aren't real. Like, we are talking on a video chat. I'll go months without seeing you. Like, in person, I have this representation of you, but it's not real. And business is the same thing. Oh, I made $30,000 this week. But you haven't seen the money. It's just numbers on the screen. So you start to get lost. And that's where having this understanding of finance makes it really easy. We were talking about this on the call the other day, that so I own a nice watch, and it's a watch I'm pretty proud of having purchased. And, you know, it's like a little personal, hey, I achieved that goal kind of thing. And I've noticed that the price of that watch has doubled. And I have a friend who bought the more expensive version of the watch. It's a Rolex. And his has also basically doubled. And, you know, you look at it and you go, wow, like when I bought that, that was worth like what, 10 cows. But now, because of inflation and because of the impact and speculation, all sorts of stuff going on, I could buy 20 cows with that, or whatever it ends up being. And it helps you create a more tangible understanding of what you have. And that's why we always say, go to the P&L, look at what are you actually buying? Like, if you can't tell me tangibly, what am I spending on this for? How does that make me money? It's not real. Oh, I listen to Spotify in the office. It makes everyone happy. Yeah, but what's the financial impact of that? Are you sure? If you take away that Spotify expense, do people become less happy and stop spending money? Or will they just use their own Spotify accounts? And that's a really, honestly, it's probably a little too simplistic, but it pushes the point across. You have to have a tangible relationship between what you are doing and how it generates cash.
Right. Yeah. And be prudent and a good steward of your money in that way.
Yeah.
So winter is coming. What else do people have to do to get a healthy financial balance sheet before winter comes? You know, to understand their liquidity, their debt, and the best ways in which to watch and measure their cash over this upcoming upheaval.
All right. So let's start with the balance sheet. So basically, a balance sheet shows you, were you good at what you did or not? And are you solvent or not? That's it in a nutshell. And the definition of insolvency, it changes based on country and law, but it's essentially, can you pay your debts when they fall due? That is the most important part of solvency. If your business is not solvent, you have to understand why. So I did a turnaround last year, did a deal on that. And what we found was because the company's cash flow wasn't managed effectively, wasn't managed as well as it could be, they'd been forced to take on debt. So their solution was, when they ran out of money, wasn't to change terms. It was to go take on lines of debt. And then that put them into this downward debt spiral where they racked up an incredible amount of debt, essentially, short-term debt, so due within 12 months or less. And they were also doing what's called revenue-based financing, remittance, which is where, so Shopify will do this, PayPal will do this, where they keep a percentage of each dollar sold. So if you have a dollar come in, they might keep 18 cents or 12 cents. And what happens is at the start, they give you this bundle of cash and you go, oh, I'm fine, because the cash in the bank is tangible. The idea of debt is not. And then you start selling stuff. But what happens is, because they're keeping 12% or whatever it is of every dollar that comes through, and your margins are so tight because you didn't manage your P&L, you're actually going down. You're in a death spiral because you're not getting enough money in to repay the debt and have surplus. You're just eking out an existence. So the first thing you've got to do is try and move as much of your short-term debt to long-term as possible. If you can, push out the maturity of your debt. Wherever possible, if you have been using debt to finance assets, make sure the life of the debt is at least as long as the life of the asset.
Well, so what's like a real-world example of that? Sure. Like, you know, we have a client named Bruce and he runs a driving school. They're probably debt on the cars. Would that, like, would you be able to finagle an example from that?
Sure. So if you own a car, let's say that the car has an expected lifespan of 10 years, just to keep it really simple, right? It's 10-year debt. The loan against that car should be at least 10 years long. That's it in a nutshell. You should match the life of the debt and the life of the asset. If you cannot match the life of the debt and the life of the asset, you either want to try and get a whole new debt provider, so go find a new lender, that's fine, or you have to come to the reality that this asset's got to work harder. Because what's happening is, debt equals lifespan of an asset's ability to pay cash flow. So the car, for example, let's just keep it real simple. He owns a car, he's got a 10-year lifespan on the car, and he expects it to make $20,000 a year, right? Real simple, 10 years, 200 grand. The debt itself might be worth 100 grand because he bought a real fancy car, or 20 grand, whatever. But you want to make sure that the payments you're making to pay down the debt are from the productivity of the car. If the debt was only a, you know, one-year loan for, let's say it was a $20,000 car, he's wiped out in that first year. There's no margin for error. But by pushing out the maturity of the debt, bit by bit, now he's got room to breathe. He can reinvest. Because debt is leverage. That's what it's meant to be. It's meant to get you surplus. and to allow you to bring in more capital than you can use. Than you can bring in without taking on that debt. Gives you leverage.
Perfect. Perfect. That's really helpful. Anything else on the balance sheet?
Again, if you're holding inventory that's slow moving, liquidate it, sell it, turn it into cash, go buy more inventory that you'll actually sell. Real simple example is if you pay $5 a t-shirt and you've had t-shirts on your books for say a year and they just don't move because you're trying to sell them at $30, go liquidate them for $5-$10. Then go take that $5-$10 and go buy a bunch more t-shirts that will actually sell. The whole point is that there is this potential capital tied up in inventory, but you do not realize it until someone gives you money for it. If no one's giving you money for that inventory at the price you want to charge, you know what? Forget about it. It sucked. Didn't work. Write it off. Sell it off. Then restart again. Like as you said, have the garage sale and then start again. Something I wanted to tap back to just real quick is you were saying about what assets you have. And something we didn't tap on was relationships. I think people severely undervalue the relationships they have and the impact of them. And it's for three reasons. The first one is IP. So you can hit me up. You and I know each other. If you hit me up and said, hey, I'm just trying to figure out how to write this piece of copy or trying to figure out what I should do with this employee. You just hit me up and tap me and say, hey, what do you think I should do? That's IP as an asset and you're borrowing it from our relationship. If we have an equitable product to promote, like you know, we've done business before, but if we have something like I have a product that your audience will value or vice versa, fantastic. We can do a partnership there. We can actually generate revenue through that relationship. And the third one, and I think this one's really important, is community as an asset is underrated in terms of your personal relationships. So in Xenophon Sirius the Great, he talks about this idea of every person has a bank account, right? So for simple math, let's say you have 100,000 in your bank account, I have 100,000 in mine. So if things go wrong, you think mentally I've got 100,000. But the truth is that through developing good relationships with individuals, through friends, partners, whatever, you actually have, so to speak, your money in their bank account. So if you need to borrow a bunch of money and your reserves are tapped, you can reach out to me because of our relationship or other mutual friends of ours, other friends you have. And it's so hard to quantify, but it's important that you focus on this as an asset in your life, because not only, it's not just financial, it's also social support, personal support. Having someone you can talk to after a really bad day and be like, man, everything's falling apart and I don't know why. That is an asset. And I just really want to beat home that part. The business journey can be difficult. It can be stressful. You need to have that asset. So I apologize. That's a quick divergence from balance sheets. But the other part of balance sheets is other than making sure your debts are pushed into the future if you can, and that they match at a minimum the lifespan of the asset, and that you've liquidated your inventory. The final question is, if you've got a bunch of cash there, how might I deploy this? What can I do with it? Because you should, after doing this, you should have a bunch of extra cash. How can I deploy this? Should I be moving into new markets? Should I be repurposing my assets? Should I, instead of trying to sell fitness programs to men over 70 who are overweight, can I take the same fitness program, change the cover, replace every word of 70-year-old with 30-year-old and sell to a new audience? How can I repurpose my assets on my balance sheet? I think that's a very important question to ask yourself.
I'm a huge believer in the, you know, your network is your net worth. And the more people you know, the easier everything is in life. The other questions, you know, so I was reading an article in chiefexecutive.net by this guy, Ram, who is a...
I'm sure.
So he went through like the 1970s inflation stuff and he's bringing the lessons through to it. And Vern Harnish recommended the article. And he was talking about a few things like cutting costly customers, which is kind of like the 80-20, like going back and figuring out where your business really makes money. So if you could talk about cutting the costly customers, another thing he talked about was how quickly can you digitize your business? He's talking about data collection and the importance of it. And if you don't have enough, what does Rob see in terms of, you know, the most important data sets to be collecting? And then in terms of innovation, you're going into inflation and recession, and a lot of people are thinking defense, 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 but what's the value of offense in all of that? So cutting costly customers, digitization of business, the data collection and the innovation aspect.
All right. Let's try and work through them backwards because I think that'll be more interesting. So innovation is a little more than a series of bets or gambits to identify what works and what doesn't. I've been recently reading a book by Mark Spitznagel, who was a partner at Nassim Taleb at Empirica. The book is, I honestly have to say, it's a bit hard, The Tao of Capital. And he gives this great explanation from his days as a trader in the pits of Chicago. And it's, you have to learn to love losing money and hate making money. And this sounds really counterintuitive until you explore it, which is when you make a bet, whether on any innovation, maybe it's a new product, maybe it's a new idea, when you test something, you are making a very specific allocation of capital, time, energy, resources to find out what happens. And every time you are told that that bet doesn't work out, so let's just say a really simple example is, hey guys, send out an email. We're going to test a small mastermind. It's going to be 5 people. It's going to be 10 grand a head. And we're going to work in cohorts. And we're going to commit our bet to this is going to be a day of writing emails and a day of building a sales page. Something real simple. It's just going to be a video with an application form. And that's what our bet's going to be. And maybe you spend those 2 days in combination of time, cost, energy, effort, et cetera, resources, and you find out no one wants it. Great. You have just removed that as an option from your brain forever. Now you make another bet. And you might say, well, okay, people didn't want that one. Let's try a group coaching 6-week program focused on getting recession ready. We send out an email about that. People interested in that. Okay, they are. Great. All right. We made a bet. We found something. Now let's extrapolate. Let's run with that. Let's exploit that opportunity. Let's work with it. And that's essentially all innovation is coming up with ideas and testing them in a way that minimizes your loss. So you always know how much you're going to spend going in. And then you can move forward when they work. You can double down, if you will. You can run it. That's innovation. Innovation has this big reputation of sexiness and all these ideas. And it sounds really illustrious. Like Steve Jobs was such an innovator. He was, but all he did was he thought about bets. And if you hear about the feedback loop on the product, people would be making a bet. Here's what we've got, Steve, and seeing whether it would land. Now, yes, he had a vision and all these other things, and Steve was very unique. It's just worth understanding that for you, you have to come up with an idea, a working hypothesis, and then make a bet and see what works. And that's it. Innovation is just little bets. Lots of bets.
The like 3M might be another example of that, where you try all these things and you end up with post-it notes, but you fail on a million other things. Or the Google, how much time were they supposed to spend? Googlers were 20%. Supposed to 20. That's a lot of time, but
yeah, one day a week.
You can make a lot of bets.
Yeah, and I think that's it. You got to have a culture of betting. Is if you look back, right? I love old stories of capitalism, right? Because it's basically the roots of where the world we live in today. But when you look at, say, the Dutch East Indies Trading Company or any of, honestly, the international voyages, what they would essentially do is a group of guys would get together and put some money together. They'd buy a ship or rent a ship, and they'd say, we bet that we can sell spice to another country. And yes, I'm keeping this really sanitized, and I'm talking about war and conflict and all this stuff. I'm just keeping it simple. The bet was we can sell this spice. And if that spice was sold and they made a bunch of money, they're going to do it again. It's just because the temporal nature of it, the timeline was so slow. It was very evident. It was very discreet. Yes, we'll go make this bet. It'll take 3 months to find out. But in modern business, you can get lost in the cacophony of chaos. There's so much stuff going on that you forget you're making bets. So having a discipline or a practice of making bets, and this could be as simple as sit down on a Friday afternoon and say, hey, what are 10 things that we could experiment with next week? And then figuring out what the cost of them is in time, energy, effort, and resources. And doing them next Monday morning and then letting the experiment run for a week. Now, I sent an email to somebody yesterday about trying Afterpay and seeing if Afterpay would meaningfully impact their business's sales and their consumer side, their retail side. That's a bet. And if we find out that it doesn't do it because there is a fee attached, and if it either cannibalizes existing sales or it doesn't have a meaningful impact on overall sales, we'll just stop doing it. But if taking a week to test Afterpay across what's essentially a couple of thousand transactions, if that works, let's run it. Let's keep doing it. Let's exploit it. But we've already capped what we're willing to bet. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. There was one story from that Ram guy's article that I thought was really interesting. He talked about how one retail company that he was working with had a difficult time increasing prices selling to Walmart. And so they hired a former Walmart executive to come in and role play with their team, which is, taking a little bit of a tiny bet, and show them how to increase their prices with Walmart. Because it's kind of like when a big company hires a former SEC lawyer.
Yeah. It's like it totally gets the game.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's all types of ways you can do the bets. So that's cool. I really like that, that way of looking at things. But the way that you described it was very important, because you kind of put parameters around it. It'll take one day, you know, here's what our bet consists of: one day of writing emails and one day of writing a sales pitch, not, you know, a very long protracted bet, or, you know, no parameters on it, where it's like, you know, you assign somebody a sales page and they go and spend 3 days on it. And now, well, you've increased your wager and probably increased the chances of you losing the bet monetarily.
Yeah. So there's a really old article, if anyone's really curious about this, comparing Victor Niederhofer and Nassim Taleb. So the article's from like 2002. It was written by Malcolm Gladwell. And this was before Nassim Taleb was like a household name in the entrepreneurial world for Anti-Fragile and Black Swan. And it's probably the best article I've ever seen written about Taleb. And what it does is it compares Taleb having learned from a guy called Victor Niederhofer, who was an infamous speculator. And I'm going to give away the whole punchline of the article here. But basically, Taleb goes and visits Niederhofer, and he's like, oh, like, I've learned so much from this guy, but I don't ever want to be him. And it turns out it's because Niederhofer and Taleb are on different sides of a bet. They're options traders, essentially. And the way it works is that Taleb buys options. He buys the right, but not the obligation to purchase an asset at some stage in the future at some price. And he says himself, I don't know what the future is going to hold. So I make these affordable bets where I lose money constantly until the big dramatic thing I'm betting on happens. And based on their options pricing model, they make a bunch of bank, huge surplus, and then start losing money again every single day until the next big payoff. And the reason that they would buy options and never sell them is because it capped their downside. It's what Taleb now refers to as a convex, smiley face, asymmetric payoff function. Niederhofer, on the other hand, where Taleb was losing money every day with Empirica and Spitznagel, Niederhofer would be selling options. So he would be making bets with people and they would pay him money. And he would do this day in, day out, for weeks, for months, for years. But the problem was that he was making a little bit of money and risking so much on that transaction, because if things went wrong, he'd be out of cash. And eventually things did go wrong. They went so wrong that he spent, after he'd sold all these options to people, they came back and said, right, we want to exercise our right to buy this stuff, that he tapped over $100 million to pay everybody off. He ended up having to sell his silverware, his art, had to take out a mortgage against his house, had to borrow money from his children. Because the way in which he constructed his bets meant that the downside was effectively unlimited. It ruined him, absolutely ruined him. And he had to rebuild from scratch. Yeah, now this is 20 odd years ago. And if you want to read up on Victor Niederhofer, go for gold. But what I really think is important to take away from this is a lot of your bets will be wrong. A lot of them will be wrong. So you want to cap how much you can lose per bet. And you want to make it so that if the bet pays off, you can just run it. Anyone who's listened to this, if you guys have run paid media yourself before, you've already got this skill, because you set up a budget of $100 a day for 3 days or whatever it is. And after 3 days, you say, hey, did that work? And if it didn't, you stop. And if it did work, you scale it. You let it run for another 3 days to validate the learnings, or you scale it up, or whatever it is your personal methodology. But that's the whole point of cutting your losers quick and letting your winners run. And that's what innovation is. It's just bets.
Which leads us to the data collection.
Ooh, this is my favorite thing. My favorite thing is data collection, because honestly, that's how I make money. Is I know how to look at big sets of data and get it from qualitative and quantitative sources and identify what a problem is and what might be causing it and how to fix it. Now, my favorite turnaround story ever is a woman called Dawn Zier, and she did Nutrisystems turnaround. And her first thing was, go get me the data. And they could tell what proportion of people who bought from them would buy again, when they'd buy again. All these insights they'd never bothered to exploit. And that's the thing about data. So you want to get your basics. You want to get, what does it cost me to acquire a customer? How much does a customer spend on average? What's my, in terms of conversion rate, my visitors to buyers, or my leads to buyers, or my opens to clicks, whatever these things are, you want to understand all these engineering pieces of your business. And it will take you a bit of time to bring it together, but then you get to look at it and say, well, how could I improve these ratios? How could I improve these performances? Or where is there an evident drop in performance that I can just go in and fix with best practices? And that's really simple stuff to do once you have the data. So marketing and sales data is key. Your expenditure data is key. Your labor production, if you're a manufacturer, is key. Now, if you're a software developer, you're probably going to look more at the coding side of things. But also, if you're a software developer or your own software, please ask yourself before adding a feature whether you need to. Is it important to build a feature, or could you use that same development and design hours into creating a free, useful tool that could then be used for marketing? So if you haven't ever seen growthtools.com, this is by Brian, who used to own videofruit.com. It's a bunch of free stuff that they then use to sell you into coaching. But if you own a software tool, maybe go make a couple of free value bomb tools that people will happily sell and prove that you know what you're talking about. So that's kind of data, sales, operations, finance. As much of it as you can. It may feel overwhelming. Get the data first, then you can worry about analyzing it. You can let the tracking run in the background.
So then into the opportunities for digitization of the business and the cutting of costly customers. How do we use that in the recession-ready approach?
Sure. So let's talk about digitization first. I got this great story that I heard about a bloke who was looking at the company, and I think it was manufacturing, and I operated across two stories. And the way it would work is someone would come in and make an order, and I would write that in my little spreadsheet, my manual pen, paper, lined book from the 40s kind of thing. And he would write out the order and the details. And then someone would have to, at the end of each day, take this notebook binder thing up the stairs and take all that and then copy everything into the next binder. This was their business. This is part of how they kept their records for inventory and all this stuff. And this bloke bought the business and just turned it into Google spreadsheets. They had a computer upstairs and downstairs. He just moved it into a spreadsheet. All the records are there, no walking up and down. Everything's straight in there. Cut the labor in half. That's a real simple example. Now, depending on who you are listening to this, you may have a business that you've been building the last 6 months, which means you're probably technologically up to date. But if your business has been around for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, if you've been doing business the same way for 30 years, you might want to ask yourself, where am I doing things manually? That's the first thing. So we were building a cold email campaign recently to contact different audiences, different segments. And the way of building this campaign was really manual. And I hate doing anything repetitively that I don't have to. So I found a plugin for Chrome called Wildfire. And Wildfire records what you do. And then you can basically edit the recording so it loops. So I set up my computer, recorded the actions that I was taking to build this list, fixed up the recording so it would loop. And then after I watched it, just repeat the process a few times, I went and got a coffee. And as I walked off to get the coffee with my assistant, I turned to her and I said, this is the best part about capitalism. You've gone and invested your time, energy, and effort and a bit of capital to make something work. And while it's doing that, I can go get a coffee. That's my favorite thing. I know that this is working. And the truth is that there's anything that you're doing manually in your business, anything where you have to click a bunch of buttons, you can probably automate. Anything that you're repeating, you can probably automate. Anything where you're using pen and paper, you can probably automate. So it requires you to know your business and have a look introspectively, but the software exists by now. Go automate it.
That's amazing. And then the 80-20 of the customers.
Mm-hmm. So a great line the other day. Your next deal should be as big as your best deal. That's what you should always be trying to do. When you start out in any endeavor to finance yourself, if you're not running off savings or debt, you take deals, you take business, you happily allow anyone to pay you just so that you can stay alive and put food on the table or whatever it might be. But it's very easy to get stuck in that group. And what you realize, if you haven't taken this off the back of our conversations already, is you can turn your assets into all sorts of revenue. And if you decide that you're going to have asset costs of $5,000 to deliver a coaching program, well, you can still sell that for $5,000, or you can sell it for $20,000 or $50,000. You just have to find a person who perceives that much value in it and will actually receive that much value from the application information. If I go do a turnaround on a $200,000 a year cafe, I can probably lift their margin a little and improve their cash flow, but they're never going to be able to pay me what I'm interested in being paid because, quite frankly, they don't have the scale. They can't collect the value that I want to realize. Like, I can't capture it from them. Whereas if I was to go do it across Starbucks, and this is not a slight at Starbucks, I'm sure you've got a great CFO. It's more that if I did it, they'd realize a lot more value off the exact same information. So I can reposition that asset. And it works in the same way if you've got clients. Some of your clients cost a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of energy. And if you remove those clients, pass them on, refer them to someone who can take care of them. But if you pass them on and then free up that space to go get a bigger client, fantastic. Or if you look at how am I managing these clients, what's the cost to service them? How can I change that? It's not worth keeping things that take cash out of your pocket. Choose to do it pro bono, make it a tax write-off, but do not force yourself to keep servicing things out of this old idea of who you were and what your business was. Your clients should change with you. The example I'd give of this, because I think it's just really cool, is the difference between Weezer and the Grateful Dead. So Weezer continues to make music for 18-year-old college kids, despite the fact that they get older. Weezer gets older every year, but they're still trying to make music for 18-year-old / college kids. Whereas the Grateful Dead makes music for deadheads. The Grateful Dead is so clear on who they're trying to make money with, who they're trying to make music for, and they allow people to come and go from that audience. Man, if you're not a Grateful Dead fan anymore, if you don't suit what we're playing, that's cool, but this is what we're doing. Whereas Weezer keeps on trying to hammer the same demographic. It's time to be a little more Grateful Dead and a little less Weezer. I think that would serve a lot of people in their business.
Fair enough. Now let's finish off with a question coming in from a friend of ours, Perry, who is talking about employee engagement and compensation during inflation. How do you keep your best people if the business starts to protract? Is there any creative ways to do that?
Sure. So I think that there's two parts. Is if you've gone through everything first, right? Let's say you've gone through the whole process. You've removed as many of your unnecessary expenses as possible. You've organized your cash flow so that it's as productive as possible or as beneficial as possible, surplus as possible. What you should be left with is a hypothesis about how an engine works, how the business makes money. And I confess, I stole the original approach to this from a former investment bank in Brazil called Garantia, who later went on to become 3G Capital. And the idea is the base salary should be low, should be forgettable essentially, but the bonuses should just be the most memorable things ever. People should get rich from adding value. So you want to talk with your employees, and some of them might not be comfortable with this. Everyone's got different risk tolerances, but you want to devise incentive plans that for the next 90 days, that incentivizes them to take actions that contribute to cash and profit. Because that's ultimately it, right? No one cares about sales. Sales are irrelevant. It's profit in theory, but cash most importantly. So structuring deals with them where they could actually earn more if they can perform better. Really key part. You also want to make sure that they have an opportunity to, or they don't have the opportunity rather, to game the system. That has to be kept with honesty and integrity. Right, because ultimately, in every system where there is incentives and rewards, people seek to game it. We've all heard the story about India and the snakes. Just be aware that this is why we do a 90-day period.
Probably worth telling again, because I don't like. If you said that in a group of 100 people, I think a lot of people would go, "Wait a minute."
Okay, so I'll probably bastardize the telling of this, but as I recall it, there was a big old rat problem in India. And this is back in the day, you know, when the UK, the Commonwealth was there. And with all these rats, they were like, well, okay, we need to catch rats. We need to kill the rats. It might have been snakes, so you know, just work with me here. The whole point was, we will pay you if you bring us a dead, with snakes, whatever.
It was a bag of snakes.
A bag of snakes, right? If you bring us the snakes, we'll pay you for the dead snakes. And as a result, they started getting people bringing in snakes. So they'd kill the snake, they'd bring it to them. Here's your money. Sweet. But what happens is some people who are very enterprising young entrepreneurs go, hang on, what you're telling me is as long as I bring you dead snakes, I make money. Well, why would I bring you all my snakes? Why wouldn't I encourage snakes to reproduce in my backyard and then just take handfuls of them at a time and just go collect my salary? This is what I'm going to go do. So they had this issue where they suddenly realized that they had misincentivized it. I think it was the British Raj with them like, well, hey, we're not going to do this anymore. You know, we've let this run for a year. You know, we've been taken advantage of. So we're not going to do it anymore. And then all these people who've been breeding snakes in the backyard were like, I don't need these snakes anymore. And let them out. Now they had a big problem again. So it's really about thinking through two things. Is one, what is the impact of the incentives I'm offering? What behaviors actually do I believe is going to happen? Not what would I like to happen, but what's going to happen? How is someone going to abuse this, take advantage of it? How might they game it? And the truth is, you don't know all of them. That's why you set it up for a 90-day window as a test. puppy dog kind of closed, as we all know. You know, try it out, see what happens. But you also want to know where you're going to get taken advantage of. You want to design a system that balances that. So there's a book, if you really want to get into it, and it's called Radical Markets, I think is what it was called. This is a recommendation that I got while I was in Uruguay. And my big takeaway is a bit of a dense book, but in Radical Markets, the idea is you want to have two forms of incentive. You want to have two mechanisms at play so that no one can fully abuse it. So the 90 days acts as a sort of incentive to abuse it for 90 days, but you might have a secondary part, which is we'll give you 5% of every sale, but only after the 45-day refund window is cleared. So that way people aren't incentivized just to get sales and then refund. They are incentivized to get sales that stick. Does that make sense? Yeah. So you just really think about how might this get abused and how do I put in a constraint against that incentive? So that's the first thing, is giving people a chance to get rich despite uncertainty by giving them a clear path to putting profits in their pocket. And that's so powerful. And it's something that sales organizations do incredibly well. And we don't actually let our employees have an opportunity to do that. You want to be able to say to them, hey, if we do X, if we achieve X, I'll give you some of that. Here's how it works.
So you kind of know Perry's business. Could you give a creative example? Because obviously, like, oh, sales guys, I'll just give them commission, that sort of stuff. But operations and that sort of stuff.
Why don't you incentivize that? I'll give you one that's not from Perry's, but I'll give you one from business I did before. So we built this out. So the first thing I want to be really clear on is, do not just guess at this. Like, you actually need to stress test this. We built out a financial model to see what the impact was to help us adjust what I'm about to share, right? So if you do want to do this, please just build out a model and test it. So we created incentives based on media spend, what the ROAS was, return on ad spend was, what the profit was in the company, and then what the ratio was. I think it was revenue against fixed costs. And we created then a formula so that if there's no profit, you don't get a commission, right? Like, the general manager would not receive any benefit if the company was not profitable. That was really important. The company must make a profit. The media buyer would not make any money if the ROAS dropped below a certain level. They had to maintain ROAS standards. They would also have to remain, they would also have to hit spend standards. So we built this out to be basically a self-correcting mechanism that if they scale too fast, we become unprofitable. The general manager won't like that. They'll have a word with them, bring profitability back. The media buyer is incentivized to get a high ROAS. If they're failing to get a positive ROAS, then their commission goes down. So they'll be incentivized to talk with the general manager and marketing team about generating better sales pages. But we basically gave people things that they could be directly in control of and then told them who else was in control of the other parts of the equation they have to work with so that they could maximize their experience. And when you do this, when you give everybody clear accountability and responsibility, they actually start brainstorming together about how to improve each other's results because they're all in it together.
Got it. It's creating that amazing loop with kind of redundancies in it that protects you and kind of optimizes.
Yeah, exactly. So when we did, for example, the general manager, the bonus they would receive was based on both margin and actual dollar value. Like, we have to hit a minimum of this dollar value and a minimum of this margin for you to get a bonus. If they were going to hold the margin, but we didn't really make any money because they didn't drive revenue and they cut ad spend or anything else, it's like a false positive. So you really, if you do want to do this, you have to sit down and just, I said it before, build a financial model. And a financial model doesn't have to be overly complex. Build a spreadsheet. Throw in some basic variables or hire someone off Upwork to help you understand what you're trying to build.
Perfect, man. Man, I do have more questions, but man, we've gone long, probably the longest podcast I've ever done. So we'll stop it here, but I will open it up to you. It's like, what did I not ask you about, or what very important points do you want to share with people so that they get recession ready and fight the inflation monster?
Yeah. So, I mean, look, here's what I really hope everyone walks away with from this week is that we are in a time where the conditions are shifted. So you may have seen this, you may not have, but the CEO of Uber sent out a memo and basically said, hey guys, like, none of you have ever been in a bull market. Our average age is below 30, or it's 30 years and under. None of you have ever, worked in a non-bull market, in a bear market. You only know bull markets. So if you're 30, you have never been in a bear market. You've never seen a recession. You don't know what that looks like. So you don't know how to act, but you've also learned an entire worldview, which, similar to that Taleb Nadelhofer scenario, might have made a lot of sense for 8 years, and then suddenly it doesn't. Nadelhofer made a lot of money, and then one day he lost it all. So really coming back to a business's job or a business functions effectively when it creates a surplus and it can sustain itself in a predictable way. So if you are owning a business, just come back to basics. Imagine piles of cash. Go take money out of the bank if you want and put the money in. Say, how much money does this bring in? How much cash? How much of this physical dirty lucre does it bring in? Where does it go? And just really make it tangible, because it's easy to hear stories about Elon Musk, and Elon Musk makes all this money. And when you look at it a couple of years back, at least, he was making a lot of money from selling on carbon credits. They weren't making money from the operations in terms of building cars. They were making it through an entirely different financial vehicle. And that can be distracting when you are a classic small business owner. It can be really, honestly, soul destroying. And we were talking with someone the other day, and his comment was that, and I agree with it, last year, crypto ruined a lot of entrepreneurs. It destroyed a lot of entrepreneurs because it disconnected them from creating value and understanding it. Most people made so much money that they were good in crypto last year and the year before, like life-changing sums. But it was so devoid of connection from process. Very few people can explain to you how they actually made the money. Now, that's not to say if you listen to this and you didn't have some, you know, great trading strategies or whatever, it's not to say you weren't positive. But for most people, you were then bombarded with these stories of people getting rich off Dogecoin or Bitcoin or Ethereum, and it turned the whole world conceptual and financial. The only reason we care about the cash in, cash out is so the business is sustainable. The only point the business exists is because it's the best use of cash. If you own a business right now, and let's say that you're selling sewing machines, manual sewing machines, it's going to be a very small demographic, and maybe the 40 hours a week you're spending selling.
My mom's going to buy one.
There you go. You got one customer. Fantastic use of 40 hours of work. But you might be better off selling electric sewing machines as opposed to old school manual ones. Or you might be better off becoming a copywriter or becoming an insurance salesperson. Just being really honest with yourself that the whole point of business isn't to post on Instagram that you're a business owner or to get on LinkedIn and write stories about how you're changing the world. The point of a business is that it's an asset that produces cash flow that puts it in your pocket. It increases your net worth. And I think we all are human. We all go through stages of life where we spend a little too much, or we get a little too miserly, or we get distracted by a relationship or the breakup or whatever it is. It's totally normal. But in these moments, especially in the middle of the storm, remind yourself what this is for. But also remind yourself that this is going to pass, man. Like, nothing's forever. Everything changes. It's not going to last forever. And you get this opportunity to ask yourself, I use the example of a wave, right? The waves are going to crash. No matter what happens, the waves are crashing, the waves are building, the waves are crashing. You get to choose how you position yourself. You can choose to swim out to the side of the waves so they don't crash on you. You can choose to paddle out and then try and surf them in. You can choose to sit on the shore. It doesn't matter. It's all happening. You get to choose what you do. And if you choose to do business, I really recommend you fill yourself with education and confidence to be able to manage your business so it does produce a surplus and you understand how.
So last question, which is, how long do you think this will last?
Saying how long will this last is an indication that it will return to normal and it will never return to normal. We have moved into this era where I honestly think if I made a financial prediction, I'm going to be wrong. I'm going to be a charlatan. If I make a psychological prediction, I believe I can back that up. 18 to 24 months, 36 months, call it 3 years. So for context, in March 2020, I made a phone call to a friend of mine and I was just checking in. Like, basically I'd landed back in Portugal after a trip to Denver, had a chat about COVID. I was like, yep, this is the real deal. This is going to happen. And we'd start preparing for it. And at the time I messaged a bunch of friends saying, hey, just a heads up. Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what we're discussing. A couple of people chimed in, saw the same issues. But at that stage, you've got to remember COVID didn't really exist for most of the Western world. They're like, oh, it's not a big issue. Oh, yeah, it's just a Chinese virus. But one of the girls is at the point where she said, look, I don't think it's going to come here. And even if it does, quarantine won't happen. And I can tell you that quarantine did come to Portugal. It was pretty intense. But because I had looked at what was likely to come, I'd gone and picked up a house in the middle of nowhere, off the grid, and spent half of the quarantine period, if not more, sitting in a hot tub, looking over the ocean with a glass of champagne that I'd thoughtfully bought beforehand because I saw it was coming. But that ended. It's the same thing with the emotions that are going on right now. Everything's changing. It's scary. And man, the news cycle loves to scare you. It wants you scared because that's what keeps you glued, because it's like, what's going to be that thing under my sink that I'm going to drink and die from? that's just how they keep you to stay paying attention after the ad breaks. If you've made it this far, chances are you will continue to make it further. You've done great. It will be a rough, weird time. And the friend who I spoke to, I told her that it would be at least 2 to 5 years of COVID madness. And she basically burst into tears on the phone with me as though I could change that. She was like, no, don't say that. No, don't make it 5 years. I was like, well, why wouldn't it be? That's pretty much what happens every time there's a major plague. It's a multi-year period. As first of all, we lock ourselves down and try and not die. And then we figure out what's real, what's not. We have an understanding of mortality and spread. And then we adapt. But it still takes a while before there's a sense of normalcy. So 3 years. Sorry if that's a bad answer, but 3 years of weirdness. And then hopefully after 3 years, there is a more consistent rhythm to our life, whatever that rhythm may be.
Well, hopefully you are extra conservative like you were with the 5 years. Thank goodness it wasn't 5 years of COVID, and hopefully it won't be. But, you know, I think that it's going to be the interesting times. It won't be the roaring 20s like we had 100 years ago. So, man, this has been fantastic. How can people reach out to you with their additional questions or find out how to get your consulting to help their mega business grow even more?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you've been paying attention, if you've enjoyed what Craig and I have said, and you'd like to talk to me about whether I could help you or if I've got something that could help you, the best way is to email me at rob@robhanly.com. That's rob@robhanly.com. There is zero E's in my last name. So if you send it to Rob Hanley with an E, I don't know if he can help you, but this Rob Hanley can. That's probably the best way to get me. I don't spend much time on Instagram these days. I actually deleted it a little while ago because I was like, this is a massive time suck. And I've got it on a tablet, but don't DM me if you need help because it will take me longer to get to you. Email is great. Beyond that, just reach out if you want to clarify something even. I spent a lot of time, energy, and effort and got a lot of scars and a lot of stories behind everything I'm sharing today. And if I can work with you to help you speed up that process, or as I've done for other companies, help you do a turnaround or grow, great, let's chat. And if maybe self-paced stuff is more your speed, we can talk about the course that I've got and maybe that'll be a good fit for you. So best thing is email me rob@robhanly.com.
Yeah, I went through your financial engineering and it saved me $6,000. So it was a 4-to-1 investment just from that alone. So absolutely.
$6,000 just this year. That's the best part. You get to benefit from that profit every single year.
Absolutely. Awesome, Rob. Thanks so much, my dude.
Thank you.